That was John McKinley with an amazing acoustic electric instrumental guitar piece called The Ontarian Song with a beautiful choral ending. John just happens to be my very special guest this week. My name is Stuart McKee, and this is Musicians FAQ. My guest this week is a singer, songwriter, guitarist extraordinaire who's been an icon and a fixture on the local scene for more than 30 years, both as a solo acoustic performer and with his band. He runs a regular jam night at the Jazz Room, and he's also got a Santana tribute band called Supernatural. He's a winner of the Mel Brown Blues Award, and he's one hell of a nice guy to boot. Please welcome to the show, John McKinley. So joining me on Musicians FAQ this week, it's John McKinley. John, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Stu, man, thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I've been looking forward to this. I mean, we've known each other for many years, the years, and seen you play out live. And I think I've even booked you a few times at some of the bars and restaurants that I ran. And So this is a real kick. I knew we'd get to it eventually. And we were saying before the show, I probably shouldn't have taken this long. But it's funny. I had a conversation with my wife, and I was talking about, you know, guys like John and Mel Brown. They're world-class players. And we're spoiled here because we're used to having them in our community. And we sometimes maybe take that for granted. And I mean, I've probably seen you play 50 times, maybe 100 times. Same with Mel Brown. But, you know, suddenly when he was gone, you kind of go, holy shit, you know, I mean, and how blessed we were to have people like you here.
So I thought, thanks for saying that.
Yeah. You know, not that I'm thinking that anything is going to happen in the near horizon. Hopefully. And John dies during my show. There you go. But anyways, I'd like to go back to the beginning, and I know some of your history, and I've heard you on Kitchener Famous with those boys, and you know, we've chatted over the years at the bar, but I don't really know that much about you personally. So for the benefit of myself and the people listening, let's talk about the early days, where you were born, where you grew up, and what your childhood was like.
Okay, Stu, I'll be happy to do that. Just so that you know, I don't think a whole lot of people know a whole lot about me personally, but they mostly know me as the persona in the, you know, play music and stuff like that. So,
right, yeah.
But I'm from Roswell, New Mexico. And that's people used to ask me in the past, you know, where the hell is that? I never heard of it. And they don't say that anymore.
No.
You're from Roswell? yeah. Did you see any aliens? Yeah,
no. Maybe you are an alien.
Yeah, I think so. But yeah, and you know, it's if you ever saw the movie American Graffiti.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, where they drag racing on the main drag and driving up and down. That's my hometown. That's exactly what it was like when I was growing up there. But that's totally so cool. Like that. You know.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So all those kind of cars, the cowboys, and the other kind of guys. One thing we had in our hometown was a military academy.
Okay.
It's actually been there since the 1800s. People go from there to West Point and stuff like that. So these guys that would be in uniform, and they're actually, it's a high school and junior college. So
right,
we interact with these guys in uniform. We call them Rudy Toots.
Okay. But,
anyway, that was kind of where I came from.
Nice. And a lot of music in the town as well. Well, first of all, actually, I'm kind of interested in the cars. So were you drag racing yourself?
No, man. I wasn't. My dad was, interesting enough, is a mechanic, and he knew how to do all that stuff. Yeah. But it just never was my forte. I used to hate having to be up in the driveway with holding a flashlight, and he's working on. He says, John, either you're gonna learn how to do this, or you're gonna pay for it. And I'm thinking, I'm gonna pay for it. So that wasn't me, dude.
I've kind of learned the same thing.
I've had friends that, I mean, like, that had some great cars. There were some beautiful cars. These are the days where cars were like, I guess they call them muscle cars these days, you know? Fastback Mustangs and 57 Chevys and Dodge Chargers souped up and just, you know. Yeah. And the street was like that. It was colorful cars, girls, you know.
That's awesome. That sounds fun. I mean, I remember a lot of people driving those cars when I was a kid here in Kitchener. And as we talked about earlier, I lived in Michigan for a little bit as a kid, but we didn't have that kind of, you know, we didn't have the racing in the streets going on and, you know, people kind of hanging out. It was a pretty tame town back then, but, you know, aside from the annual car show or something like that. But so what was it like as a kid? I mean, and what about the musical influences and things like that?
Well, let's see. As a kid, school was cool. I mean, it was. I was the only kid in the grade school I went to that had a white last name. Everything was Martinez or Chavez or, you know, it was on that right. part of town, okay. right? Yeah. But so that was interesting. But if you wanted music, you would go to. They had dances and they had. I think they had something like that here in Kitchener too. Where they would skate and they would play music at the skating thing. Yeah. Except this wasn't a DJ, this was a band's playing. And there was a couple of really good bands in town where I'd go listen, I'd watch the guitar players. I'd stand right up, you know, just check out their hands, see what they were doing. Because, I mean, it was mystery to me. I wanted to play, but I didn't know what they were doing. So, you know, in those days, I don't know if you remember a guitar band called The Ventures.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, it went from that, and then when the Beatles hit, it was like, whoa, you know, everything went kind of British, you know?
Yeah, I know, for sure.
Yeah, so it was all bands playing cover tunes. There was really no, nobody doing any original music there, except for one guy, and I wound up playing with that guy, and we started writing songs, right?
So, oh, cool. Anybody we've heard of, or is he just long from the past?
He you never heard of him musically. Later on, he got heard of. He became one of those sort of UFO kind of guys, and you can look him up on YouTube. Some of the he's since passed away. Yeah. So, anyway, musically he saved my life in a way. Can I tell you that story?
Yeah, please. Yeah, that sounds. You got me hooked already.
Okay. Well, as I was coming out of high school, I was, you know, the Vietnam War was happening, and I was if you went to university, you didn't they weren't going to take you.
Right.
Okay? So the thing was, if you didn't want to go to university, your number would probably come up. Right.
Sure.
So, my dad had arranged it. My dad was used to work in the military and stuff, and he arranged it so that I had an interview with these guys at that very college I told you about, that military academy that was in town, and I was going to trade 2 years of junior college there, and then following that 6 years as a lieutenant in Vietnam. I was going to do that.
Oh my.
For the education. That was my college deal, right? And I actually started that, but that I was still in high school when we had done that, and that spring, some guy came walking in, this guy here, he came walking into the choir room of the high school where I was at. He had been a former student. He was looking for some girls to sing on the background of his new record that he was doing.
Okay.
And he brought a tape, and he was showing it to the choir director, and I'm listening. I'm a senior. I'm just about to graduate. And then he went off to go talk to somebody, and I grabbed my guitar, which was in there, right? Because I used to play guitar for the choir, and I learned a song. And it was an intricate song. It was very Beatles-like, you know. Wow. And as he came back in, he saw me playing his song, and he said, "You already know how to play my song?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "You want to play on it?" I went, "Yeah."
Oh, man.
So I got to go with the girls down to the studio, and I got to put acoustic guitar on it, right? And he says, "We should be in a band." I said, "Oh, at the end of summer, I got to go to boot camp, and then I'm going to be 2 years junior college." And he goes, "No, man." He says, the "Nashville's asking me about this record." And I'm going, "Really?" And so I made a decision. I thought, okay, I'll take my chances. I'm going to go the music route. I really upset my father because he had done a lot to pull strings to get me that
far. Sure, yeah.
And I didn't show up for boot camp. And instead, I went with his band. And Nashville didn't happen, but I was lucky I didn't go to Vietnam. They didn't choose me. So.
Oh, thank God.
So anyway, his name was Jose Escamilla. So I got to thank Jose for that. You know,
oh, that's brilliant. That's a great story.
But you know, like when it comes right down to it, the artist in you goes like, well, do I really want to go over there and carry a gun and do all? I mean,
yeah.
Not that that's something you'd want to do. It just looked like there was no other choice.
Right.
And then, but when you get something like music or aesthetics coming up and going bang, you go like, nah, it talks to my heart. So I made a decision.
Well, thank God. Now, were you, you know, not to get too personal, but I mean, were there people in your town that you knew that didn't come back from the war?
Oh yeah, man. Yeah, there were, there was a really good friend of mine and he was just the nicest guy. And he went and he joined the Marines. I don't know why he joined the Marines. Everybody knows the Marines go in there first, and they And he, you know, I even saw him afterwards. He wasn't even the same guy. I mean, like he was very, you know, he was just a laid back dude before that. His name was Jim Riviera, and he didn't make it. And then some guys that did come back,
just never the same. Eh?
Oh, one time we're sitting around. This is like maybe 2 or 3 years later. And, you know, a bunch of people playing music, sitting down, playing guitars. And this guy noticed, you could tell who was in the army because they had really short hair.
Right.
You know, he had this messed up arm like this, right? And I thought, oh, did that happen? Did you get hit with shrapnel or something? He says, no, man. He says, I became a junkie over there. That's from a bad needle. I'm like, what?
Oh.
And then I realized, oh, there's this whole other story of, what happened to guys, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, we don't have to get into that. But I did see that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, well, that's too bad. Well, thank God you never went that route.
I'm out of here.
Quando chove vuoi, quando chove vuoi, quando chove vuoi.
That was John McKinley with Quando Jo Mi Voy. What a great tune. So what about like family members, musicians, singers, like songwriters? Were you kind of an oddity, or were there other people in your family, immediate or extended family, who were musical?
My mom sang. She had a great voice and she could harmonize really well. So I could hear harmony right away. Right. That helped me. My dad had an old guitar, but didn't really do much with it. Showed me how to tune it. And when I said, I need lessons, he said, he threw a Melway book at me. He said, here, that's your lessons. Yeah. Okay, so I just learned chords. But no, not really. I did have an aunt who was a dancer.
Okay.
Well, what she had, and she was a professional. I mean, she'd put on shows and stuff, and she'd been in New York and Los right. Angeles and all over. And so I would help her sometimes with her shows, play the music for her, putting like a DJ, you know.
Nice.
And she had a great record collection, so I would listen to stuff like West Side Story, and I mean, this is old stuff.
it wasn't
even rock yet, right? The Time Out by the Dave Brubeck Quartet, you know, it has Take Five.
Oh, yeah.
Sketches of Spain, Miles Davis. She had stuff like that, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's so wild. My wife and I, she was searching the soundtrack to Bosch. We watched Bosch on Prime, and he listened to a lot of jazz. And that's all the stuff we were listening to yesterday, Miles Davis. And then that Dave Brubeck album cover came up on Spotify on the screen. I went, my parents had that album. And
You know the one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, with that kind of abstract picture on it. And
that's the one. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And I mean, they had the West Side Story soundtrack and Man from La Mancha. They had, you know, Benny Goodman and then Johnny Cash. I mean, that was the one thing that my dad and I bonded over was Johnny Cash. But so random. But yeah, such great stuff, man. Now you talked about watching the guitar players and things like that play, and you were playing guitar at that point. This was in high school, or
actually, I started messing with the guitar probably around 10 years old.
Okay,
but then I got into sports, and then I got into girls, and then you know the clothes you wear at school, and I didn't do it, and then. Around 14 or 15, I started again, and I just noticed that, well, this appealed to me.
Okay.
And, you know, music had, by that time, the Beatles and the Stones and Animals and all those guys were out.
Great time.
Jimi Hendrix had just showed up, so I thought, I got a long way to go, buddy.
Yeah, no kidding.
I realized that I could learn more than just my A chord, my D chord, my G chord. I better start learning some of this other stuff. That's when I was paying attention to what the guys were doing, because I knew there was something they were doing that I didn't know how to do.
Yeah, yeah, cool. And so the first guitar you had was an acoustic guitar?
Yeah, yeah. It was my dad's old K.
Okay.
And you could put an arrow on it and pew, shoot it. It was bowed like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
And I said to him, man, this is really, really a lot of work. And I didn't realize you could play a good guitar. That's different.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, I love to kind of look online and reverb.com and these places, and you see some of these old K guitars. And I watched a guy playing one time, and it had just had this great sound. And he's talking about, you know, it's a cheap guitar, but it just, some of them, he goes, you know, some of them are just crap, but some of them, you play them, they got this great little vintage sound. And so I started looking for them online, and, you know, some of them aren't cheap now because they're, you know, they've become these collector's items. And
oh man, if I would have known, if I would have kept all the things I had.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding.
I had a Nocaster. I don't know if you know what that is, but
it sounds familiar.
The first Telecasters were called Broadcasters.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. And there was one in the middle there that didn't have a decal or a decal or whatever you call it on the, that said Fender.
Okay.
And that's called a Nocaster because it had nothing, but it was one of those. It only had one pickup and it had a pewter nut, not plastic, that was pewter.
Right.
And I didn't realize that it was probably early 50s, maybe even 40s on that one. Yeah. And I traded it in because I wanted the Les Paul, and they gave me $100 for it.
Nice. And was it actually, were those actually made by Fender, or was it another?
You can look them up. They're called, they're called a note. I don't know why they didn't have a decal on them, but they were called a note caster.
It's funny. I've got a book behind me, the red one. I don't know if you can kind of see the top of it, but it, and maybe you've read it. It's called The Story of Loud. And it was basically the origins of the battles between sort of Les Paul and Leo Fender and trying to build these guitars. And then all of the other guys that were Bigsley and the different people who were involved as well. So I remember the Broadcaster being mentioned. I don't remember the Nocaster, but that's kind of wild. Yeah.
Well, it was an odd thing. Somebody told me, no, that I said, I called it a Telecaster because I thought it was a Tele. It looks like a Tele, right?
Yeah.
No, that's not a Tele. It only has one pickup. Doesn't have the front one. Then we found out what year it was made. It would probably be a Broadcaster. Okay. Right. But everybody thought it was funny that it didn't have a thing on it. I thought somebody sanded it off or something.
Yeah.
Then I found out later there was something called a Nocaster where they didn't have a decal on them.
That's so awesome.
Anyway.
Nice little piece of trivia there. Well, that's very cool. So
here's some trivia for you. You mentioned Bixby.
Yeah.
In town. I don't know. Do you know Glenn Affelt?
Name sounds very familiar.
Really great guitar player from town. His family all played guitar. His dad used to play pedal steel. Okay. And his dad worked with Bixby to create the Bixby thing. And they live right here in Kitchener.
That's wild.
And because, I don't know if his dad's still alive. I think he is. But because of his dad's connection to these early guitar things, what's the name of the guitar that Carlos Santana plays now?
I can see it, but I'm blanking.
Anyway, whenever that guy has a little conference or something like that, or a little party, he gets invited to it. Glenn does because of his dad, and he sat and talked to Carlos Santana and stuff like that.
That's very cool.
Is it a PS something or?
I'm gonna have to look that up after the show. And I know the guitar because I remember looking it up the last time I saw him playing. I was watching something from House of Blues where they had the original Santana band from with Neil Sean and everybody back together. And I'm like, what the hell is he playing these days? And
PRS.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool. Paul Reed Smith.
Paul Reed Smith. That's what I was thinking. Yeah. Thank you.
Anyway, I just thought I'd give you that little bit of trivia. There's a guy right from Kitchener that we've seen Bixby's all over. He helped develop the Bixby with Bixby.
That's so cool. Well, thanks for that. That's awesome. Yeah. So when did you start kind of realizing, I mean, I guess as these things happen, were there records beyond like some of the ones you mentioned with the jazz and some of the West Side Story and the Oddball records, but like Hendrix and the Beatles and these guys were coming along. So what was the first album that you actually bought or the first 45 singles? You remember those?
Oh yeah. Like the very first album I bought was a Dave Clark 5 album.
Okay.
It was called American Tour.
Nice.
And I liked the band because they had a sax. I thought it was cool. Yeah. And by that time, I was into the Beatles too, but I didn't own one. I mean, I was like 10 years old, right?
So, yeah.
But the girls that were at my grandmother's house, they were teens and stuff. They had the Beatles albums. I spent all my time in their room listening, looking at the album covers. So I was into the Beatles too. I just didn't own anything.
Yeah.
So, but the first one was the Dave Clark 5. And the first single I got was probably Nowhere Man by the Beatles.
Cool. Yeah, nice. Yeah, I mean, what a great time to be coming up. And I mean, you know, I would have killed. I remember, I think my first conscious memories would have been around 1969 when I was living in Michigan, hearing a lot of great stuff on the music on the radio from kind of that era and those bands, but it was more probably, I don't have a conscious memory of listening to them. I remember coming to Canada and my brother taking me out to buy a 45 single, and I wanted to get a Beatles single. And we were looking at the bin at Sam the Record Man. I think they're 99 cents. And then with tax, $1.07. So my brother lent me the dime to cover the tax. And I remember he pulls out Hey Jude, and I'm like, I don't recognize that one. You know, I recognize a few Beatles names, and he goes, no, trust me, you love this song. And I don't remember consciously hearing it. I didn't recognize the title. Now, mind you, I'm only 6 or 7 years old at this point. So my life is very short. But when you're a little kid, you know, I went home, I put the record on. And it was like, time stood still. I was like having this out of body experience. Like I've been reincarnated and I'd heard this in a previous life. And I was like, oh my God. And like, even to this day, it's still my favorite recording. But there's so many good ones. I mean, Hendrix All Along the Watchtower. And I mean, just that whole era was just insane. It must've been great for you coming up during that and having to be conscious of it.
Yeah. I remember I was in my mom's car. We're driving and All Along the Watchtower came on and I'm hearing that, you know, the first guitar thing
yeah.
that does. And it just, my ear went like, whoa, you know? And then as they started singing, I thought, oh, that's Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
But I hadn't heard that song yet, you know? And then, it blew me away. It's just what a gorgeous tune. Now there's a really good example of a collaboration, sort of, you know, yeah. indirectly, of an incredible songwriter
yeah.
who's great with lyrics, Bob Dylan. But his version doesn't sound like that because he's not as hip a musician as Hendrix. And then this incredible musician, and you put the two together, what a perfect marriage. That's one of the best songs ever, you know. Yeah,
I agree. That just blows my mind to this day. I mean, you know, Layla by Derek and the Domino too. Like, I mean, the sophistication in some of those recordings at the time is incredible. And I think I was just hearing something lately, and I remember hearing stories about how Hendrix drove everybody nuts. It was like a 24-hour recording session. And he couldn't get the sound that was in his head. And he kept, come on, come on, come on. But I didn't realize that he apparently played bass on that session. Because I
yeah.
guess, there's a Noel Redding, the bass player, stayed home. He didn't think, he goes, it's late and everybody's been drinking. It's not going to be very productive. I'm just staying in. And,
you know, I think with Jimmy that you have to kind of call your shots because Jeff Beck even said he'd come over to New York to visit at the time that Jimmy had, you know, the studios going and all that. And of course, he's in New York, Jeff Beck. He said, let's go party. Let's go to the clubs. Let's go see somebody. And he said, we'd be at a club for maybe 20, 30 minutes. And Jimmy said, let's go jam.
Yeah.
And then they'd go back to the studio. He says, like, all the guy wanted to do was play guitar.
Yeah.
It's like, he said, it got to you after a while. It's like, come on, let's have some fun, man. You know?
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, I mean, I heard that he never without his guitar, slept with it, whatever. But, I mean, paid off, I guess, in the sense of making him so legendary, but short life, sadly.
cause I'm a passionate man. Ooh, yeah, passionate man. I'm a passionate man, yeah. A passionate man.
John McKinley, once again, with a song called Passionate Man.
So, obviously, a lot of those songs are very inspiring. Was there one particular song or one particular album or one particular musician that really triggered you and said, okay, this is what I want to do? Or was it later in life that you kind of figured out?
Well, actually, there was one that made me take a turn, made me adjust my course, if you will, because I had gotten into the Simon and Garfunkel thing, and I was actually pretty good at finger picking stuff.
Right. Okay.
So I could do The Boxer and April Come She Will. I could do all that stuff. And I had a guy that could sing Garfunkel's part, so we would do Simon and Garfunkel stuff, right?
Oh, cool.
And then that friend went off to university, came back to that very first break with some other university friends, and they had the Led Zeppelin 2 album, which I'd never seen, right? So they put up, but I'd heard, I heard on the radio, the little short version that edited. But they put it on my stereo, so we're sitting there listening, and then this big long thing in the middle, I said, wow, that's really cool. And then, you know, the drums come in and that guitar solo, da 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 ba dum ba 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 da, and my ear just went like, what? And that guitar, it just blew me away. I thought, that is, and I'd already heard Hendrix, and I'd already heard lots of stuff, and I went like, okay, I'm going to play electric guitar. I thought, Jimmy Page's solo, that right? That's gorgeous.
Yeah,
I mean, it, the production on it was perfect. It blew me away, man. I was like,
It's funny because I'm sure many of us, but I had, and it's funny because that was my trajectory as well. I mean, it was that moment of listening to that middle piece and that drum roll and that solo. I was like, I converted. I'm like, Jimmy Page is my guy. I'm like, holy crap. And I bought every Zeppelin album, and, you know, I was all psyched up to go see them in concert. And then, of course, you know, tragedy hit twice. I mean, I remember my sister talking about getting tickets, and then Robert Plant's son died. And then I remember her talking about tickets, and then John Bonham died. But it's crazy how just a couple minutes, or not even like 30 seconds of music, can just, whoa.
Exactly. And, you know, I distinctly remember the other guys, they were older than me, you know. I was still in high school, and my buddy and his friends are, so they're sophisticated, they're talking about this and that, and they were real audiophiles, so they listened to a lot of music. And I remember them saying, yeah, I'm really getting to love heavy music, man. Yeah, me too, yeah. And now, when I look back at it, I realize the word heavy metal wasn't even around in those days.
Yeah.
Hard rock was, but they were already calling this heavy music as opposed to hard rock.
Right.
Like hard rock was more like Cream or even Jimi Hendrix, or that was psychedelic too. But I mean, like, you know, this was just the beginning of that whole thing, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I think Zeppelin are in a category all their own. Them, the Beatles, you know.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, it's incredible even to this day. In fact, I was working out before our interview, and I was listening to Zeppelin. I was listening to Presence. I mean, and that's a heavy album. I mean, there's no keyboards on that album. It's just all guitar, drums, and bass, and Robert Plant's incredible vocal. And, it stands the test of time for sure. There is nobody doing that stuff. And, you know, whether you're, and I know there are some haters. I remember a friend of mine, his brother, and I won't mention his name, but his brother was a journalist for the record, and he would do the weekly record reviews. And, you know, he used to wear a shirt that said Springsteen is God, or E Street Band is the greatest band in the world, or something like that. And I was just getting into Springsteen then, and I'm a huge Springsteen fan now. Didn't appreciate it quite at the time, but he had no respect for Zeppelin at all. And I went, you are fucking insane, man. It's like, I said, you know, I mean, if you don't like it, that's one thing. But, you know, but what I found over the years, a lot of times when people discard people, myself included, it's because they haven't really listened to much. Like, people say, you know, okay, well, name me 5 Led Zeppelin songs. And of course he couldn't. So I said, well, you know, maybe listen a little deeper, a little harder before you make that statement. But
that was good, Stu. Name me 5. I'm going to reuse that. Because, you know what it is okay, I'm going to wax philosophy here a little bit, some musical philosophy. I'm more of a of a composer than right. I am a songwriter. Like, I mean, I can write songs and but the distinction I'm making is I like music. I mean, yeah. I like music. I listen to all kinds of stuff. And I like the way music fits and what you can do with it. And yeah. I wanted to figure out how does that work? And when you listen to Zeppelin, okay, let's just, for example, let's just take the two bands that came out at that same time that people keep talking about that were at the beginning of what later became called heavy metal. The other one was Black Sabbath. Okay, yeah. Now, they're a great band. And if you're a guitar guy and all that, it's great, you know. But you look at them musically, like what they're actually doing compositionally, there's no comparison. There just isn't. Like Jimmy Page is an incredible composer. You know, he's got some incredible stuff that he's doing. And if you look at it from just a musical aspect, I mean, they're incredible. In fact, I used to do this with people. I'd say, I'm going to play a rhythm. I'm not even going to play sing the music or anything. And you tell me what song it is. And right. and they'll know it's Zeppelin.
Yeah.
You watch Zeppelin, you can recognize a Zeppelin tune by the rhythm alone.
That's right.
Because that's how, anyway.
It's deep and it swings. And I think a lot of it, I mean, and yeah, I love Black Sabbath too, but I mean, and they've got a unique sound, but they're kind of one dimensional. I mean, I think they had an album called Never Say Die later in their career, which was completely oddball from everything else they did. And the odd song here or there, but yeah, it wasn't, you know, Zeppelin, every single album was different. And I mean, it was, you know, and I think Sabbath were a bunch of guys that grew up in the same town and were buddies and they started jamming together and that's how their songs came out. Whereas, yeah. like you said, you know, with Page, he's composing. I mean, he had all that session background for years, being a top session player on every kind of session too, like jazz and blues and rockabilly and pop. And then you've yeah. got, you know, the guys that he picked to be in that band. I mean, John Paul Jones was a session guy and a multi-instrumentalist. And I mean, you listen to John Bonham's drumming and it swings. I mean, it does. It's got stuff that, I mean, it's not just heavy plodding. I mean, it's got a swing to it and it's, yeah.
It does. And in fact, if you, it's really hard to duplicate that swing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He's got a really unique touch. And it's funny. I saw the Jason Bonham Experience and he talked about how, you know, everybody thought his dad just beat the crap out of the drums, but it wasn't. It was just, he had a certain touch and the way that they mic'd the kit, which I think was more of a Glenn Johns thing or maybe a Jimmy Page thing. I'm not sure, but they just got that sound that it sounds like, I mean, the guy must be, you know, 250 pounds and 10 feet tall and just beating the crap out of it. But he was just a little guy. Bonham wasn't that big a guy.
Well, I do remember Jimmy Page saying that he had gotten this one amp. It was a Vox AC30.
Right.
And he said, I got it set up, man. It's got the perfect tone and all that. He says the first session he had with Bonham in this place when they got together, he realized that's not going to cut it. I'm going to need Marshall.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why. I mean, maybe he did beat those drums harder than anybody.
I think it's technique. Like you
yeah,
said.
I think, yeah, I think it's technique and maybe the way he tuned them and whatever it was, but man, yeah, it was heavy. And I think that's what I like about Zeppelin is that you can hear all four. I mean, I guess Robert Plant kind of said it the one time, he said, really, it's a power trio. And I never really thought about that because, I mean, he's a singer, but his voice is so instrumental. Like, it's almost like another instrument, and he's a hell of a harmonica player. But when you hear him and Page kind of sparring and trading licks vocally versus guitar, I mean, he's really another musician in the band in my mind.
Exactly.
But what's cool about that band is, I mean, you know, we want to get back to talking about you, but you got me excited about it. It's like you can hear everybody individually. Like, you can hear the bass, you can hear the drums, you can hear, like, it's not like just the guitar out front. Like, you can hear everybody playing. But I mean, I didn't realize until later what a great producer that Jimmy Page was in terms of mixing all that stuff and making it balance right. And, you know, that those subtleties of really loud and then really quiet. And yeah, I mean, some serious nuances.
See, everything you just said there, the really loud and the really quiet, each one was a different instrument. You could hear it the way it was made. Yeah. Those are all musical terms. Those are, that's why it was so musical. It was actually musical, you know,
as
opposed to just being music for consumption.
Well, we're going to have to go out one night and have a couple of beers and just listen to Zeppelin and talk Zeppelin all night. But let's get back to John McKinley. So obviously you made a bit of a turn on that path and the electric guitar came in the picture. Did you have a Les Paul at this point or you're saying
no, in fact, I still didn't. Okay. sorry, it's going to come back to Zeppelin. Yeah. I still didn't even know what a Les Paul was. We went and saw this band and came to town from Dallas called Baby. They were a great band. Now, they had two Les Pauls, and there were harmonies lines, right? And it sounded so beautiful. I asked the guy I was with, the guitar player, I said, "What is that?" He said, "That's a Les Paul." I said, "I like that guitar. I'd never seen one." Yeah. So, I mean, this is a little town I'm from. They didn't have much. So then I went to the music store and I said, "Have you got a Les Paul?" And he pulled one out of the back. It wasn't even in the front. Dusted off the thing, opened it up. And there's the guitar. It's this one.
Oh, no
this
kidding.
This is the one. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then and I said, "Good, I'll take it." And it took me about a year to save up enough That's the one I put the down payment on my telly on. And anyway, so then, fast forward a couple years later, we go see Zeppelin. I'm living in Albuquerque by now. Zeppelin comes to the Albuquerque Arena, and they walk out on stage, and this guy comes, and he's got a Les Paul, and he's putting it on, the tech is putting the Les Paul on Jim Page. And I said, "He plays a Les Paul." We didn't know. There was no,
it's not like
there was
today.
No magazines that showed you that stuff.
Yeah.
Right? So it was, that's the answer to the question is, I didn't know that. I thought it was a cool guitar, you know?
Yeah, that's funny. Well, and I don't think I realized until later as I got more into Zeppelin that, you know, Page did play Tellys and Strats as well, of course, which makes sense. But I always it was the same thing. I wanted to get, I mean, I've got a collection of the different guitars, not that I'm, you know, that great a guitar player, but just a fan of the music. And, you know, I've got the Telly and the Strat and the Les Paul and the SG because I wanted, you know, there's each different people that I, you know, love, like Tony Iommi plays the SG or Jerry Garcia used to play an SG. And Page and the Les Paul, that's what, you know, really got me excited, right? And then, of course, Clapton with the Strat. But then Clapton was one of the ones that kind of brought the Les Paul back when it almost went extinct because of the Beano album and with
exactly. And in fact, when he was recording, sorry, it's going to go back to Zeppelin. But when he was recording that album, the engineer was saying, because Clapton had the 45 watt, what's now called a Blues Breaker because of that album, Marshall, which was new at the time, and a Les Paul. And he had this tone. And the engineer is saying, because Jimmy Page was in the control room watching. And the engineer says, "I this guy's unrecordable. I can't get him to turn down." Jimmy Page says, "I don't know what to do." And the guy says, "Go ahead." So all Jimmy Page did is turn the fader down and let him play at the volume he wanted to get the tone he wanted. And I'm sure Jimmy was going, "Okay, Les Paul, Marshall, right?" You know, I'm sure he was doing that, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, and that's another great story that I had just heard recently that Jimmy Page was on that session. I think I was reading something with him because I'm always reading all these old magazines and they do re-editions now of the old magazines. So I was reading an interview and I didn't know that he was on that session because I'd heard the story about the engineer going, "Oh, I can't record this guy and it's too loud." And I remember hearing a comment about where John Mayall said, "Just let God play." But I didn't know until recently that Jimmy Page was in that session. So, I mean, it totally makes sense, like you said. But, yeah, it's crazy.
Anyway, the mythology grows.
Yes, no kidding.
That was John McKinley with Rev It Up.
So now, did you play in Texas at some point? Or, I mean, I thought I heard kind of some stories about you playing with some of the blues guys down there in Texas. And
Yeah. I wound up in Austin. One of the New Mexico bands went through all Texas, and we were booked by a Texas booking agency, and they, man, you can spend all your lifetime just traveling Texas.
There's
lots to do there.
It's big.
But I wound up in Austin because the band broke up, and I got with another band, and long story, I wound up there for a little bit, and so I would run into guys, and I would be in different bands, and it was a real interesting town because it had the country thing, the outlaw country thing was starting to happen. Plus, it had this blues thing because of Antones, right? And then it had a real rock thing. And in fact, one of the guy that helped me get my boogie, was Eric Johnson, right?
Okay, yeah.
Like in those days, you could not get a Mesa boogie. They didn't sell them in stores. You had to order them from the guy that made them. And you couldn't get his number anywhere. So I remember I was in a music store, and I asked the guy, I said, how do you get a boogie? He says, I don't know. He says, I know a guy in town that's got one. What's his name? He said, Eric Johnson. Here's his number. So I called him up. He gave me the number, told me how to do it and everything, and that's how I got my boogie. But
that's great.
It was a rock town too, you know.
Yeah.
And so in Texas, you play blues. If you're a country guy, you know how to play blues. If you're a rock guy, you know how to play blues. You just play blues. It's not you didn't have to be a quote unquote blues guitar player. Right. Now, there were some guys that really were purists, and there were some guys that sucked at it. But I mean, like, you know, it was a town. There were incredible musicians there, and that aren't famous, you know.
So all
I can say is, you know, you tried to do the best you could when you played blues. You tried to be authentic as you could, you know. I find that there's a whole different way. I don't want to get technical, but there's a whole different way that they go about it as opposed to what somebody who would go to a teacher, let's say, would get from a teacher. Because you can't get that out of a book. You kind of get, I mean, you can, but it doesn't sound like the guy that said, look, this is what you see. Got that? Okay, good. That's it. That's how you get it, right?
Well, I mean, if you're plugged in there and you want to give us an example, I mean, by all means, go ahead.
Can I?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've had a couple people. Yeah, well, James Anthony played some stuff live on the show when I interviewed him, and Griffin Brothers did a tune live as well, which is very cool.
Now, Stu, I know this is only an hour show, and I realize I'm talking a lot.
That's okay. We can do a two part show, John. Don't worry about it.
Okay, there's this thing, the pentatonic scale. And apparently there's five different positions you can play it up the neck.
Right.
I don't know any of those. And neither do most of the guys that play down there. What you do is you learn this one. And you put a little thing on top of it. A little, what they call an extension, or I call it extension. You've heard that a million times, right?
Yeah.
So you put that on top of this. You duplicate that up here. And you put that up here too. So now you've got an octave up. The same thing here. And then you connect them with a scale that goes across the whole neck diagonally, like this. And that's it. That's all you need. And that, out of that you get. It's very useful, and you can only get those sounds here. You can't get them playing everything like this. If you learn to play this way, then it boxes you in, and you sound like you're playing this way. But if you learn to play diagonally, then you sound different, you know. And that's one thing I noticed that they do there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, yeah, I mean, everybody up here, I mean, kids that I all grew up with, I mean, we're all learning the pentatonic and we're learning the five positions, and it's a son of a bitch to learn that. And yeah.
Oh, you think Muddy Waters? And I tell you where I think it comes from. I think because you remember the original blues was guys like Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson going with a slide, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, with a slide, it makes sense to play it because you can't bend the slide like you can your fingers, right?
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? You can't get that kind of. So you got to play it wherever you got straight, wherever you got harmonies, right? So that's why I think that the other guitar players that played blues who weren't slide players, I think they probably developed from them copying what the slide guys did.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, and I don't know if you remember a guy, I'm sure you do, Steve Adams, that used to play and teach in the area. I think he passed away maybe 20 years ago. He had Steve Adams Guitar Studio. And I think he had touched on that one time in a lesson with me where he was talking about the sort of connector scale. And, you know, and I never really got back to it. And I think I will now.
Hi, this is John McKinley, and you are listening to Musicians FAQ on CKMS 102.7 Radio, Waterloo, with your host, Stuart McKee.
You a young man down at the casino, betting high stakes on a losing pair of dice. Walking through the room in a brand new tuxedo, left flat broke with a used pair of dice. Oh, he was rolling.